This is Martha Nix Wade with An Exposed Secret. This is about making you stronger, that as you listen, you will be a stronger parent. You will be a stronger person because you've been enlightened to what goes on in the world of sexual abuse. We want to protect our children from ever experiencing sexual abuse. And for those of you who have experienced sexual abuse personally, we want to help you be restored and experience a healing process. And hopefully, as you listen, you will start to experience both. You will be empowered by the realness of what we are sharing. And today, I'm very thankful to have Agent Botella with us. And would you please just tell us a little bit about your work?
Sure. I'm a special agent in Los Angeles assigned to the SAFE team. It's a sexual assault felony enforcement team. I've been assigned there for approximately 8 years. And we work investigations and dealing with crimes against children, anything from internet pornography and child pornography to child prostitution, as well as child sex tourism, that is individuals who travel to foreign countries for the purposes of engaging in sex with minors.
And how long have you been focused on the protection of children?
I've been assigned to the SAFE team for approximately 8 years. Prior to that, I've been with the FBI for a little over 25 years.
And what did you do beforehand?
Before I was with the FBI, I worked for U.S. Customs Service for about 3 years. That was just after graduating from San Diego State University with a BS degree in criminal justice.
What led you specifically to work with children in protecting them?
When I first started with the FBI, I was very involved and very, very much looking to do investigations. And my first assignment was working bank fraud here in Los Angeles. And I really enjoyed looking after that particular investigation and finding those individuals who were perpetrating fraud. I then was assigned to work healthcare fraud in Los Angeles. And at that point in time, I worked there for approximately 9 years. One of the individuals who was assigned to work crimes against children was an associate of mine, a fellow agent, and I asked him at one point in time, how do you feel about working that type of violation? And because he always got asked, you know, when you see what's going on, I mean, how can you work that stuff? You know, it's got to be really draining on you emotionally. And I remember his comment was, you know, when you see the suffering and the abuse that goes on with these kids, you know, how can you not work this violation? And that kind of struck a chord in me in saying, you know, this guy, he was absolutely right. My coworker was absolutely right. When you see the struggle that the families go through and the victims go through, you know, and it's just become more pervasive dealing with the internet and those types of violations. You know, I believe that the FBI should continue to work these violations and we should address and put more resources to these types of crimes.
Well, I know of personally watching you work with a family. You are amazing at your job.
Well, thank you.
How you stand by families and equip them to get through the trauma of knowing that their child was violated by another, and that you understand the heart of a father and the heart of a mom, and you are truly there for those families and an advocate for them, and they are stronger in facing the perpetrator because of you and your work. And I'm very thankful for what you do.
Well, I do appreciate that, and I thank you for your comments. It is probably one of the most difficult things that I have ever had to do, and that is to contact a family and inform them that we believe and we have allegations or suspicions or even evidence to believe that their child has been sexually abused. And it's a very difficult thing because being a father of four children myself, I try to put myself in that position and try to understand what this family must be going through and just the world kind of collapsing around them because it's other than the death of a child, this is something that is so dramatic and so traumatic for them that I try to put myself in that position. And there is some training that the FBI gives us in dealing with families of this type of violation. But oftentimes it's just through common sense and the sensitivity that you have for people and what they're going through that helps me to kind of put myself in their shoes and hopefully say the things and do the things that it's going to help this family get back on the road to recovery. It's a long process. Oftentimes it's a long journey, but it's a step in the right direction when they have law enforcement and our victim witness people that can come on board and give them resources and counseling and medical advice and different resources that they can go to start to begin the healing process that the family so desperately needs.
About how long is it from when you have evidence to the point in which there's hopefully a sentencing of the perpetrator?
That can vary depending on the type of violation that we're talking about. Most of my cases deal with the internet. And if we have individuals who are sharing child pornography, the sexual exploitation of children, or sexually explicit images or videos on the internet, and we find out about it, oftentimes when we conduct a search warrant, we're not really sure on who the victims are in the photos. So every time we go and do a search warrant, every time we seize evidence from a particular home where we believe the individual in the residence is downloading child pornography, all of the images have to be sent back to NCMEC, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and they run it through a database, all of the images, through hash values to determine whether or not they've seen those images before and whether they can identify the victim in those particular images. So it's sometimes a long process depending on how many computers we seize from the residents, how long it takes us to do the forensic exam of the computers, gather all of the images, all of the videos, and then send it to NCMEC for a matching report. And then once we get the report from NCMEC, they'll come back and tell us, here's how many images we found on the computer or that you found, and here's the victims that we know we've identified. And then we'll go back and do a search because oftentimes we won't even find the pictures that they've traded. We find pictures that the individual's actually taken themselves. So we take search warrant photos of the residents so that when we go back and do the forensic exam of the computer, we can look in the background of those images and see if that looks like the house that we did the search warrant out. And maybe we have an individual who's actually producing or manufacturing these types of images. It's not just trading them off the internet or taking them from somebody else. This person is actually taking pictures of actual children or actual victims.
And then what, as a parent, do I need to know to better protect my children from what is taking place on the internet and explain all these elements of what our kids are in danger of experiencing while being on the internet?
Well, the first thing I think that that parents should know is to do whatever they can to educate themselves on the internet, the way it works, what their child has access to, how to put blockers on certain websites, different types of software that they can install on their computer so that the parent's child can be monitored. There's software that can even monitor the number of keystrokes, the type of keystrokes, pictures being sent, emails being sent, chats, those types of things. The other thing is we've had cases where I've gone out to elementary schools. We give talks, and part of our investigation is also education. So we've gone out a number of times and given talks to parent-teacher associations or different organizations, Boys and Girls Clubs, church organizations, and so forth. And I'm always fascinated by how many of our young people have computers, laptops, that they keep in their bedroom. There'll be maybe 70% of a class that has a laptop or has a smartphone or some type of device that has internet connection. And then I ask them, of those who have computers, how many of them have webcams on those computers? And you still get a large percentage of our young people who have webcams on their computers in their bedrooms. It's still kind of surprising to me that that parents don't realize that there's only one purpose for a webcam, and that's to display, you know, a picture. And it can be used for good purposes. You know, Skype, you have a family member who's in a different country or a different state or whatever, you want to Skype with them, that's fine. But oftentimes we find it used by perpetrators to either hack into a young person's computer and turn their webcam on remotely without the child even knowing that it's on. We've had a number of cases like that where the perpetrator has been able to send them a spam or some type of virus. They open up that email. Now that perpetrator has access to that computer. They can turn it on, turn it off, turn the webcam on whenever they want. And what does a young, you know, young girl, 12, 13, 14 years old, do in her bedroom? You know, whatever a young girl does. And these individuals have the ability to do that. So I always tell them that, you know, put a t-shirt over the webcam when they're done, close the cover. These are just minor steps that we can do to protect our kids. One of the other things we hear most often is, you know, keep the computer in a public area, put it in the family room, put it in the kitchen. My personal opinion, I really don't see a need for a young person to have a laptop computer in their bedroom. It just invites that child to possibly be involved in some type of, you know, activity that the parent won't know about. We've had instances where the parent would go out and buy software to monitor the child's activity on the internet, but the parent doesn't know how to install it. So they give it to the child to install. And of course, there's a password that's required to install it. And the child puts the password on. So they easily can go back into that particular software, put in the password, and turn that particular software program off. So now mom doesn't even know what sites are going to. So just education about the computer, how it works. You don't have to be, you know, a computer science person to understand a computer, but you really need to know where your child's going on the internet, what they're able and allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. Chat rooms, it's another place of vulnerability for young people because that's where predators go. These guys that we've investigated for since I've been involved and I've seen a number of them, they spend time on the computer. They spend time on the internet. They oftentimes have nothing other to do but to go on the internet and find out where our young people are going, whether it's chat rooms, whether it's Facebook, whether it's MySpace, Twitter, wherever it happens to be. These guys will spend the time to find out because that's their prey, so to speak. These are predators, and their prey is our children, and they will go where these children are at, and right now it's on the internet.
And they take the time to carefully study what is popular within that age bracket that they're targeting. So if they're into 12-year-olds, they know exactly what 12-year-olds talk about. And they're usually posing themselves as a younger person, maybe a little bit older to have a little, you know, sense of allure, but they're absolutely posing themselves as someone different than who they are. And there's that commercial that they're saying, well, where'd you hear that? On the internet. Well, do you believe everything's true on the internet? She says, yes. And she goes, here's my boyfriend. He's a French model. This frumpy guy comes for bonjour. And she found him on the internet because everything's real on the internet. And our kids don't realize that just because someone says they're 15, 16, 17, that they're probably not.
Right. Right. We see that so often with our what we call our traveler cases. We have law enforcement officers who go undercover online. It's not a secret. Many law enforcement agencies do that. They'll go undercover posing as minors to various chat rooms or MySpace, Facebook, where it happens to go, because we know that that's where these predators are. And we can oftentimes easily find out who these people are just by the way they talk. I've talked and portrayed myself to be a minor, sometimes a boy, sometimes a girl, in different scenarios.
You look nothing like a girl.
Yeah, and I can't get my voice quite high enough. we have law enforcement officers, mostly female, that can portray themselves, their voice, to be a young 13, 14-year-old girl. But when I go out and give talks, I have what we call chat logs, and I will show the kids the chat, an actual chat between myself and a perpetrator. And we go through the chat, and I ask the kids, generally junior high, tell me when you think this person is what we call grooming. When is he grooming? When we're going to read through the chat, you raise your hand if you think this person is grooming.
And for our listeners, could you define grooming, please?
Yeah, grooming is a method that these perpetrators use to try to get the person that they're chatting with, in this case, minors, to be comfortable with what their topic is. And he's trying to get that person to be more comfortable and more willing to possibly meet with him in the future. For instance, if we have a young girl who maybe doesn't have a lot of friends at school, she has a difficult time with her self-confidence, but she goes online and this person's telling her when they exchange pictures, oh, you're the most beautiful girl I've seen. I can't believe that you don't have a boyfriend. How come the boys aren't after you? If I went to your school, I would be your boyfriend. That's a grooming process. That's this perpetrator trying to build the confidence of this victim so that they will become friends eventually, and the victim will then trust this perpetrator and possibly meet this person at a McDonald's for a burger or a milkshake or what have you, knowing full well what his intention is down the road. And that is to possibly engage in some type of sex act with this minor. And so those are what we call our traveler cases. And like I said, I oftentimes go to schools and we'll go through a chat and you'll see where the person says, why don't you send me a picture? And the victim may say, or the minor may say, well, you didn't send me one. And the perpetrator will say, okay, well, I guess you don't want to be friends. And I see a bunch of kids raise their hand. Because who doesn't want to have friends? But this person is telling them, if you don't send me a picture, we can't be friends. That's just one step of the grooming process that we see oftentimes in these chats with minors. They'll ask questions about what your family does. Where's your mom work? What time does she work? What's her schedule? You know, where's your father at? Because they want to see how accessible this child is going to be. Now, we generally will go on, you know, different ages. 10 years old, 11 years old, more likely not to be able to leave the house without mom or dad or somebody. But when you start getting 13, 14 years old, you get a little more independence. Your mom may allow you to go down to the 7-Eleven and get a Slurpee, or maybe go to the McDonald's. So we see oftentimes our perpetrators will target a particular age because they know that that's the age or the maturity level where they get a little bit more independence to act on their own. When you start getting 16, 17 years old, I mean, most of the kids know what's up. They're not going to go meet somebody at a McDonald's unless they know who it is. That's not to say we don't have cases like that, but generally it's the 12, 13, 14-year range that we see that.
So what can parents do besides, you know, knowing, understanding the computer? What is it that they need to teach their children about the possibilities of perpetrators being online? What do most kids not know? I mean, they know everything about the computer, but what are they missing when they're putting stuff out there on Instagram and Facebook? What do kids not understand as a danger?
One of the things that we've tried to educate kids, especially when you start getting into the fifth, sixth, seventh, junior high, middle school age, and it is about 83% of our victims dealing with sexual exploitation of children over the internet. About 83% of our victims met the offender willingly. You know, in other words, you don't have a perpetrator, for the most part, hiding in the bushes, ready to jump out when you're walking home from school. Fortunately, that doesn't happen as often. It does happen on occasion, but that's generally not the norm. We have these young girls being groomed or being told that this person is their boyfriend at 17, 19, whatever it happens to be. And so they're going to go willingly to go and meet this particular person. So as a parent, I would say, again, find out what your children are doing online. If they're going to chat rooms, what's the purpose for going to a chat room? Is it to learn information about a particular topic? Is it just to meet friends? And if so, do they really know who they're chatting with? We have this little cartoon that I like to show the kids. It's a dog typing on a computer and another dog who's standing by. And the one dog is saying, I can be whoever I want on the internet. You know, no one knows I'm a dog. And that's entirely true. I mean, you look at even adults when you go to, you know, Match.com or dating sites. I mean, how much that information is actually true? You know, it's the same thing with our kids. Our kids need to know that who they're chatting with, more than likely, is not who this person pretending to be. And so if you treat it as that and you know that this is just somebody who's pretending to be 15, 16, 17 and wants to be your friend, then maybe there's no harm to it. But when we start getting our young people to believe that they're chatting with somebody who wants to be their best friend and has their best interest in mind, that's when we start having problems with these types of perpetrators. I mean, you know, Facebook is a great tool. It's a great site. It's a networking, social networking site. But again, how many people have Facebook accounts and how many friends do they have on Facebook and how many of those people are actually their friends? You know, I think the terminology or the term friend oftentimes for our young people has a different connotation than what we maybe adults know to be friends.
Absolutely. And kids put out their personal information there. They have huge arguments and discussions out there in the open for everybody to see. And it's so dangerous that they're letting the whole world see the drama that's taking place, because then the perpetrator can think that they're going to come in and help them in their moment of weakness and then ultimately violate them in their vulnerability.
That's absolutely right. We've had a number of occasions where one particular case I recall with Facebook where the young girl had her Facebook private. And so nobody could access her Facebook. They couldn't see her personal information, couldn't see her friends, couldn't see anything about her without her accepting somebody to be a friend. And she basically said, I didn't accept anybody unless I really knew who they were. Well, the one thing that she had on her Facebook was the school that she went to. She went to a high school, and that was the only thing that she had other than her picture on her Facebook. And again, these perpetrators, these predators, they spend time. If they really want to find you, they will spend the time to do it. And what this guy did was he went to the public library in the area where that high school was, and he pulled the yearbooks for that particular high school, and he found the picture of the girl who had the Facebook account. Then what he did is he looked at a boy in that same class, created a phony Facebook page using that boy's name, sent a friend request to the young girl. Is she going to accept? Yeah, she knows this person. She goes to school with this person. She accepted him, and now that perpetrator has access to everything on her Facebook. Solely from that one high school was the only thing that she put on her Facebook. So I say that because I want to stress the importance of anybody can spend time trying to track a particular person. So we have to do everything we can to educate our kids that this could happen. Hopefully it doesn't happen, but we have to do everything to prevent it from happening. And the big part of that is educating our children.
So when do you think is an age-appropriate time for a child to have a Facebook account?
Well, Facebook says that 16, that I believe 16 is the age that you can. But we all know that all you need to do is have a legitimate email account, and you just fake your date of birth and say you're 16 when you're really 12, and you can have access to a Facebook account. My children have Facebook accounts.
I'm horrified.
I monitor the Facebook accounts. But the one thing that we also found out is oftentimes children will tell you about the Facebook account that they want you to know about. They often have two or three Facebook accounts. One that parents can see that has all the good stuff and the good pictures. And then sometimes they'll have a Facebook account that doesn't have the so-called good pictures and the good information. So, you know, ask your child, how many Facebook accounts do you have? And if I find one that we don't know about, then your computer privileges are basically suspended. We have to do things that protect our children. And our children are going to talk about the fact that they feel like they're adults, or they should have the privacy so that parents don't look at their information. Again, it's not a matter of privacy. It's a matter of protecting our kids and making sure that we have an understanding with our child of the dangers out there on the internet. And so if we can educate our kids and we can put more trust in our kids, then they're going to trust us, and they're going to come to us when certain things that pop up on the internet, they find out they're chatting with a 22-year-old. They need to cut that communication off, delete their screen name, create a new screen name, a new profile, wherever they happen to be, because that's not appropriate.
And I see it as accountability, that no matter how old any of us are, we need accountability for our actions. And if we're doing what's right, we shouldn't be afraid of being held accountable. It's when we're being sneaky and underhanded that we really don't want to be held accountable. So if we're going to live, you know, right lives that are honorable, so be it. Let's have some accountability. And that's how our kids should feel. Not that we're, you know, looking over their shoulder and not trusting them, but it's like holding them accountable. And like you said, keeping them safe.
And that's entirely true. And I totally agree with you. We see victims come from all types of families. We're talking about broken families, one parent families. We see victims from, you know, two parent families who have stable jobs, mom's at home, dad's at work. It's an ideal family from the outside. And it's not one particular group of persons or one class of persons or whatever. It runs a spectrum from very affluent families to very, very poor families. And so to think that, well, my child goes to a private school, therefore they're getting the best education, they're from a loving family, why would they get on the internet and chat with somebody who tells them that they're, you know, 16 or 17 when they're really, you know, 24, and then build up this friendship or this relationship where this my child is going to go out and meet somebody who they've never met before and they don't know who they are. That would never happen. Well, you know, unfortunately, we don't understand sometimes our children's in the way they think, and it does happen, and that's why we try to do everything we can to educate children about that.
And very often, when people understand what I do with the Quarter Blue, they say, "Oh, you help those people," as if it's only to a certain race or a certain economic status. And it's like, wait, I'm those people. And I'm was white, middle, upper class. What's those people? Or one day a lady said in Spanish, she said, oh, she helps. And she said under her breath, the poor people. Mm. And it's like, that's not how predators look. They're not preying solely upon the poor or the whites or whomever. They're seriously looking at someone who doesn't feel whole and is vulnerable and willing to let someone befriend them and groom them and ultimately violate them.
That's absolutely right. I mean, one of the cases I worked dealt with the victim's father, the young boy. His father was a LA County deputy sheriff. I mean, so you got a police officer who's the father of this particular victim. And so if it can happen to the family members of our law enforcement community, it can happen to anyone. And so that's one thing that we try to, a myth that we try to, tell them the truth. And that is it can happen to any family. It can happen to any young person. And so education is key.
What are other myths you think that people believe?
A couple of other myths that we talk about dealing with stranger danger, that works really, really well with young kids. You know, when somebody comes up to them and offers them a ride or says, hey, come help me look for my puppy or whatever, we talk to these kids about stranger danger, you know, be aware of strangers. And that works up to a particular age. And then, like I said before, when you start getting into junior high or middle school, stranger danger is not really applicable to kids. They know what a stranger is by that time. What they don't know is who that person is on the other line, on the other side of the computer. So stranger danger is good, I think, to a certain age. But to stress that to our young people, they need to be more aware of who's out there on the internet and the time that these people are putting in to go after what we call the prey, and that's our young people.
And with molestation, we really shouldn't solely teach our kids about stranger danger, because for molestation, it's typically by a family member or a trusted adult or even a trusted young family member that's older than the child. And statistically, you'll see anywhere from 92% is someone you know and trust, or even higher than that. And the stranger that's going to assault our kids sexually and not use the internet, this is someone whom we've met, the percentage is so small for someone, like you said, who's going to just grab you off the streets or snatch you off the park. And so often I hear parents say to me, oh, I don't need your information. I'll watch my child like a hawk at the park. Well, my parents were known as extremely overprotective. In high school, my parents would say, oh, your parents are so overprotective. So my parents were overprotective, and I was molested from at least the age of 7 to 12.
So again, you're a prime example of exactly what you're speaking about. And that is, you know, the stranger danger is great for young kids, but we also have to teach them about family members. And as, you know, as terrible as that sounds sometimes to tell our children, be careful of your family members or what have you. As terrible as that sounds, we do have to educate them, because there are certain things that are not appropriate, even for, you know, grandma and grandpa or aunt and uncle or whatever. And the earlier that we can educate our children about what is appropriate contact, what is appropriate touching, what mom and dad are able to do, and what grandma and grandpa aren't, or aunt and uncle or neighbor or, you know, cousin or what have you, then I think it becomes more ingrained in the child's mind. When something does happen, they're more apt to go and tell the parents, listen, you know, this is what happened to me, and I didn't feel good about it, or didn't feel right, or we've had a conversation, and you told me that when somebody touches my private parts or whatever, I'm supposed to come and tell you, and that happened. And so education, again, at an early age, I think is a key. One of the things that I've talked to family members, and they'll say, you know, well, we checked the Megan's Law website, and we know where the violators are in our neighborhood.
Right.
And that's good. It's always good to know where the people who have prior convictions for sexual abuse or sex violations, where they live. That's great. And I think Megan's Law is a great tool. But I go a little bit beyond that and say, okay, those are the ones that you know about.
Right.
How many other neighbors live in your neighborhood or live in your community that you don't know about what they do? And that oftentimes parents will think, well, you know, I never thought about that. You know, I just assume that the sex registrants or the people who were involved, I just needed to know where they are.
Yeah, those are the only ones who got caught. And statistically, it says that 1 out of 20 men are sexual predators.
And that's a staggering statistic when you think about it, because if you look just in your own family or you look just in your own neighborhood, your own cul-de-sac or whatever, you're talking about 1 in 20. I would be pretty sure that most people have, you know, 20 men that live within, you know, 100 yards of
Absolutely.
Where their home is. So you got one of those individuals, you know, is in that category.
And I'm not trying to call out only men. There are female predators. One, they are statistically less. It's 1 out of 3,030 women. But it's difficult because a lot of times that's when it's a girl perpetrating a girl. But often when it's a girl perpetrating a boy, they don't make the statistics.
That's correct, and oftentimes I think we see now in our culture when that happens, you'll generally, I don't know, for some reason it's lately it's been teachers,
right,
female teachers engaging in some type of inappropriate contact or relationship with a male minor, and I guess sometimes our society looks at that and says, well, what a lucky boy.
You Which know? Is a lie. I mean, I had, a male say to me, then why have I spent a lifetime on a counseling couch?
Right.
When all of my family members said I was the luckiest guy on earth to learn from my aunt, I don't feel lucky.
No matter whether it's a female perpetrator, a male perpetrator, or what have you, the child knows that that's not an appropriate relationship. That's just not the way it's supposed to work out.
Right. They're so completely conflicted.
Exactly. And oftentimes we see that with young boys who are perpetrated or abused by males, that their sexuality begins to become, you know, questioned. They're not sure. Did I allow this to happen? And if I did, does that mean I'm homosexual? Or, you know, I didn't want it to happen, but it kind of felt good when it did happen. Therefore, I must be gay. I mean, those are all the confusing things that go through a young person's mind.
And I think that's some people don't understand that. You know, there's a curriculum that's called Good Touch, Bad Touch. And our bodies, while in our head we might be conflicted and think, oh, this is not right. Our bodies, the endorphins are going crazy. And there's a part of it that can truly feel good. And that's where we get really confused, because we know we shouldn't be doing this, but our body's stimulated. And then we're completely confused, and then we take on the guilt. When we have no guilt to bear, it's not our fault as victims.
And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we have, you know, age of consent laws in the United States and in different states. And in different states, it varies as far as the age of consent. But there are age of consent laws because we as a society believe that a child, a minor, whether it's 16, whether it's 17 or 18, doesn't have the mental capacity, doesn't have the experience, the life experience to make those types of choices. And if we're going to say that as a society, that we have young people who don't have the maturity or the experience or the knowledge that they need to make a consent to some type of sex act, then we have to do everything we can to protect those people so they're not preyed upon by these predators.
Now, what do you think is the challenge for kids with cell phones now?
Well, cell phones brings into a whole different dilemma that we've been dealing with probably for the past 5, 6, 7 years, and that is the sexting. It's sexting is dealing with sexual images, whether it be pictures or videos, and also texting. So they termed it sexting, and it is the number one problem in the schools today.
Over what?
Over drugs, over gangs, sexting is the number one problem. We've been told by school administrators and school staff, teachers, that it is such an epidemic in our society, in our young people's schools, that they're trying to come to law enforcement to find out what they can do to stem this type of activity. And only recently are states putting into practice or signing legislation to create laws that will not classify the offender as a sex offender, because technology has advanced so quickly that oftentimes the only laws on the books for these types of crimes were sex crimes, which means that if you've got a 15-year-old who sends a naked picture to his girlfriend and it's found, that's child pornography. He gets charged as a sex registrant, and he has to basically be a sex registrant oftentimes for the rest of his life.
And he's on Megan's Law for sending a naked picture of himself to his
Megan's
girlfriend.
Law, correct. And that's because technology moves so quickly with cell phones and smartphones and computers and so forth that the laws didn't keep up with that type of activity. And only probably within the last few years, we've started to implement laws and sign legislation for particularly minors involved in sexting, where oftentimes the states will say the first time offense, they have to go to a mandated counseling and understand what sexting is and the ramifications of child pornography and so forth. Then there's a second offense, and then the third offense oftentimes will bring charges against that particular person. But at least we're educating our kids on the severity of these types of images. And you've heard it said before that anytime a picture goes on the internet, it's there forever. It's there forever. Even if you delete it, it's been on the internet. You don't know who's downloaded that picture, and now it's in their computer. And if they ever wanted to distribute it, all they have to go back on the computer and distribute that image, and now your image is back out there again. So we tell our young people, and it's difficult because they don't understand sometimes the longevity of these right. types of images.
They're so in the moment.
They're so in the moment because they're in love with their boyfriend or their girlfriend, and you know, it's just, it's proper, or it's the right thing to do, or they just, you know, whatever their rationale is, that these images are going to be there forever.
And they think it's between two people.
Right. And they don't understand because it's they can't comprehend when we tell them, okay, when your boyfriend breaks up with you, what do you think he's going to do with those naked pictures? They don't ever see them breaking up with their boyfriend. Their
right.
boyfriend is going to be there for forever. You know, they're in love and they're going to get married. But we see it time and time again. Oftentimes when these pictures come back up and they're distributed, it's because the relationship has soured. And the boy wants to show his friends that his girlfriend sent him some naked pictures. And again, that's child pornography. And when the boy distributes or sends those images to his buddies at school, that's distribution of child pornography. And those carry mandatory sentences if they're charged in the federal system.
That's amazing. What's the difference between something that happens, let's say, in a city compared to federal? Where do you step in and get involved?
Well, the federal government gets involved, the FBI particularly gets involved when we're dealing with an interstate aspect, whether it's the use of the computer, which deals with interstate, goes back and forth. There's servers in different states, different countries, and so forth. So the material information is being disseminated across the internet, which has an interstate nexus. The same thing with cell phones. The cell phone's going to go from your phone to a cell tower to a server, and then it's ultimately going to go to whoever you're sending it to. So you deal with interstate commerce or interstate access or nexus. So that's when the federal government, the FBI, gets involved. If we're dealing with a molestation case where you're talking about a next-door neighbor molesting a child who lived next door to him, it's not going to rise to the level of a federal investigation because there's no federal nexus there. But we do work. The SAFE team is a task force. It's a multi-agency task force. We have the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, Los Angeles Police Department, California Highway Patrol, Los Angeles District Attorney's Office, California Department of Justice, a number of agencies that work alongside with us. So even if it doesn't rise to the level of a federal case, a federal investigation, we will still work the case, we'll still investigate the case, and ultimately charge it on the state level with the district attorney's office or the city attorney's office.
So if a child is molested and in addition to the physical interaction, it was photographed or videoed, then distributed, then that's where you are absolutely involved because those videos were sent across state lines.
That's correct. And our statutes say that somebody who distributes child pornography is looking at a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence. And production of child pornography, somebody who produces, takes pictures of child pornography, it's a 15-year mandatory minimum sentence in the federal system.
I'm actually sick that it's only 5 and 15. Does that drive you absolutely nuts?
Not necessarily. We work within the parameters. We've had a number of cases where we charged on the federal side because of the production of child pornography. But we look at the state codes and the state statutes to determine where we're going to get the most sentence. Oftentimes, if we believe a person needs to be incarcerated for years, then we'll look at that. And we've oftentimes dismissed the federal case because the person can be charged on the state side and receive a much stiffer sentence. One in particular, we had an individual that we investigated who was taking pictures, and he was looking at a 15-year mandatory minimum sentence. In other words, he's going to do 15 years. That's the minimum. And it's a mandatory sentence. The judges can't depart from that.
So the judge could actually say it's more than 15. That's the minimum.
That's the minimum. Judge can say 20.
So we need to really get our judges educated on the long-term effects of
definitely.
And on child pornography.
And on this particular case, because there were multiple victims, the state statutes indicate that they could get 30 years to life. So we dismissed on the federal case and charged him on the state side, and he ended up getting 30 to life. So he'll be in custody for a long time.
It's just difficult when you know that your child or you yourself have experienced sexual abuse when you hear five years. Because really, for us as victims of sexual abuse, it's a lifetime sentence. Whether it be just having triggers at different points in life, whether it be, you know, you have your first child and then you're triggered on how could somebody do it to a child, or where maybe you come across an image of another child and you're thinking, where are my images that were taken when I was a little girl? I mean, the lasting effects of someone perpetrating you as a child, it's difficult to hear those numbers, but I know that as we educate law enforcement and judges, and hopefully they'll have a better understanding of what victims are going through and truly bring down the best sentences possible for the worst case scenario.
I absolutely agree. And we talk about the fact that when we talk about distribution of child pornography is one of the violations that we work, and it carries, you know, a minimum sentence, mandatory sentence. That's distribution. In other words, that's somebody that's downloading pictures or has pictures and is sending them to somebody else, distribution. And oftentimes we have many people in law enforcement and in the judicial system that see that as somewhat of a lower level violation, because we look at that and say, well, it's just pictures. They're not actually molesting kids. There have been a number of studies. One in particular is the Butner study, where they looked at individuals who were incarcerated solely for possession of pictures or distributing of pictures. They were not convicted of any type of sex crime or sex act, but they were able to do a survey, an anonymous survey of those particular people, and those particular inmates who were convicted of that. And surprising, it was like 75 to 80% of those individuals admitted to contact offenses that law enforcement never knew about. So when you have individuals who you say, well, they only had pictures of naked kids, or they were only sharing pictures of naked kids, you know, the studies show that we may not know about all of the sexual, you know, abuse or sexual contact or deviance activity that these individuals have, because they were only convicted of the possession of the pictures.
Two of the words I hate typically are just and only. And a lot of times people try to minimize either their abuse that they personally experienced, or they minimize their offense. And when people say just, when it deals with sexual abuse, it just breaks my heart, because I work with victims and I work with their families, and I see the burdens that they bear and what they experience day in and day out because of, it could have been one act, But the shadow that that casts upon them, especially if they don't get the help that they need, is just when they say just, it drops them in a place where they don't feel like they have to fight for life and wholeness. And they don't have to feel as if what happened to them was minimized, that it was only an uncle, it was only a cousin, it wasn't my dad. You know what? You don't need to minimize what happened to you. And I know that Agent Patella, when he was using those words, just and only, it was to make the point of there's something more, and they're in the process of finding out what's truly going on with these individuals. I had a man say to me once, please speak on my behalf. You know I'm not a pedophile, and so-and-so's saying I'm a pedophile. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't know what you do behind closed doors. I cannot do that.
That's absolutely right. And when we say just, you know, just pictures, or it's just distributing pictures of naked kids or what have you, I know from my experience and work in these types of cases, it's never just. There's always more. And we try to do everything we can as law enforcement officers and law enforcement agents to try to determine exactly how many victims we have with each particular offender. So much so that we will do extensive investigations to find out what his past history was. Was he ever a soccer coach or a baseball coach? Did he ever coach Little League? Did he ever have contact with kids or go to was he ever a camp counselor? Those are the types of investigations that we look for. We try to do everything we can, because statistics show us that if he was if he was an offender, an abuser, a molester of kids, and he was a camp counselor, you know, 10 years ago during the summer months or what have you, we possibly have additional victims. And we can't go on with an investigation. We can't close our investigation and move on until we believe that every child, every victim that we can find has been contacted, has been interviewed, and we can walk away from that case and say we're fairly confident that we've found all the victims we can. And it's difficult oftentimes to close a case because you have a sense that there's more victims, but you've turned every stone, you've talked to hundreds of people at times, but yet there's something inside that says there's more out there. And which one of our children, which one of our young people are suffering because this person committed a sex act or a sex crime against them, and he's never told anybody, he's because of shame or whatever reason, and yet he's living with that every single day of his life. And ultimately, he's going to find a marriage partner, and they're going to get married, hopefully. But that's always going to stay with him. And what effect is that going to have on the relationship? Because that's all he's known from the time he was abused until the time that, you know, he goes on with his life.
And so often victims say, oh, I've moved on. That's behind me. And unfortunately, we can't say that. There's a portion of it that's always with us, and we're not necessarily in control of when we will have a trigger or a memory. And as we deal with it, and that's our point at A Quarter Blue and on An Exposed Secret, is to give you a voice, to give you a place to share your experience, because you will feel a greater sense of empowerment as you share your story. And we encourage families quite often when they say, well, it's just my son, and the family doesn't want us to bring it up. You know, the family just, you know, he's only 17, and let's just give him a life. We'll ruin his life if we bring this up. Well, what about the 7-year-old?
Exactly right. And that's why one of the greatest resources that we have with the FBI and the federal government is the fact that we make available the resources. And oftentimes the families aren't prepared, or they're not ready to go through counseling. We make it available for the family. We make it available for the siblings. We make it available for any family member that was affected by the victimization of this child. And oftentimes we won't get any calls from a particular family for counseling or some type of resource or whatever it happens to be, oftentimes for a couple of years, but we make it available to them. It's basically whenever they are ready to deal with it and want to talk about it, or they're having problems in their life, and they look back and they think about, you know what, I wonder if it had to do with when my child or my brother was sexually molested. And if they can make that connection and go and seek the resources and the help that's going to make them a better person, then we make that available. And it doesn't matter whether it's a year, 2 years, 5 years down the road, those resources are still available to them because they were victimized and they're considered a victim.
That's amazing that you don't have a statute on counseling, because that's very true that you may think you're fine at that moment. And maybe it's, you know, you were able to go through trial and you feel like you've moved on at sentencing day. And then you have a trigger. And then if you feel like you have nowhere to turn, that they can turn to the FBI and still have those resources is truly amazing.
Yeah, it's a great program. And we have a great victim assistance person. Debbie Deem is our victim witness person. And she does a tremendous job, not only with our crimes against children and the internet and sexual exploitation, but also child prostitution and also our child sex tourism. Dealing with all kinds of victims across the board, and is willing and able to assist us in all of our investigations. And she does a tremendous job. So,
do you often find when you go to investigate a case and you have one victim, and I know you said that you try to look at all places where they had contact with children, do you usually find more victims?
It's hard to say on a percentage of how many cases where we find multiple victims, but if I had to throw a percentage out there, I would say probably about half of our cases where we have one victim that we know about or has come to our attention, we're going to find another victim, whether it's something that happened during the same time or in the past. There's generally going to be another victim, unless just by chance this is the sole victim that this person's ever, you know, molested or abused, and we happen to find that very first victim, there are other victims, and it's just a matter of doing some investigation to try to uncover who those people are.
And that's why I want to encourage, if you're, you know for a fact that your child has experienced molestation at the hand of an individual, whether it be on a meeting after being on the internet or a family member, that you do report it, because you're not only giving your child a voice and an opportunity to protect themselves and get that individual the help they need, but you're probably protecting society from a predator. Because like you said earlier in the program, that they seek out how to connect with a child and fulfill their sick fantasies. And they will study very carefully how to make that happen. And we need to stand up and stop this. If we know that a perpetrator is out there, we need to be brave and step forward to the authorities.
That's correct. And any time we sometimes get a little afraid that we're going to accuse someone or we're going to bring attention to a particular person because maybe it was only, did I really see what I think I saw? Or is this child really confusing with what happened with something that was maybe just playful or whatever. But we don't have that luxury to make that decision. We need to contact law enforcement. We need to contact whatever authorities we can. They'll do the investigation. They'll come back and determine whether it was a miscommunication or a playful act or what have you. But at least let law enforcement make that determination rather than having a parent dismiss it as something that doesn't need to be looked into.
Right. We can actually impede the investigation if we try to dig too deep and try to come with all the facts to law enforcement. If we suspect abuse, we need to go immediately to the authorities and tell them what we do know and allow them to take over and do their job.
That's correct.
Well, I really appreciate you being with us. And I want you to just give a last word to parents and to victims. What are the two things you'd want them to remember out of anything? For parents first,
I would say communication. Talk with your children. Know what they're involved with. Know who their friends are. Know what they're doing on the internet. No matter whether they think that you're prying into their private life or what have you, we have an obligation to our children. They are our greatest resource. They're our future. And if we are not going to protect them as parents, who is? We need to stand up and we need to take control of what our families are doing, what our children are doing, not because we want to nail them down to find every single thing they're doing through the day, but because we care about them and we love them and we want the best for them.
Perfect. And to the victims out there, what do you want to say to them?
Continue to speak up. Continue to have a voice. Continue to fight for justice, for perpetrators who have offended you and will offend others, and to continue to fight for what you believe in, and fight to become healed, moving forward with your life so that you can be a sign and a symbol to other victims that possibly could be abused in the future.
You stand up with courage and know that, you know, beauty can come out of what you've experienced. And there's a beauty awaiting you as you stand up and shout out what happened to you, as you get help and you break the cycle within your family and protect the kids around you. This is Martha Nix Wade with An Exposed Secret. Please like us on Facebook and get involved. Thank you so much for being with us. Agent Patella, you have been awesome in explaining so much to us.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Have a great night.
As we awake to what remains.